For a good bit of this year, we've been talking about what's called the Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path. And we've worked our way through the elements of the Noble Eightfold Path: right understanding, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, and right effort. Now we're at right mindfulness. The remaining element is right concentration, which will be discussed at another time. But I want to kind of dive into right mindfulness for a bunch of meetings. And the four foundations of mindfulness is what right mindfulness is. So I've been teaching people mindfulness meditation for many, many years. I thought it might be interesting to just talk about what is mindfulness. So that's what I'm going to focus on this evening. The term for mindfulness is sati in Pali, which is a classic language of Buddhism. And the Four Foundations of Mindfulness discourse is actually the Satipatthana Sutta. Sati means roughly mindfulness, but I want to talk about that more specifically, obviously, more expansively. And the other root word, Satipatthana, Upatthana, which is translated as to establish or to keep close at hand. The word sutta comes from the same history, Indo-European history, as the word suture. Of course, the suture is what you use to bind up a wound. So a sutta or sutra in Sanskrit is a teaching that's meant to bind up the wound of dukkha, which is usually translated as suffering, but those who know me know that I prefer the words distress and confusion. So, sati is derived from the Sanskrit term smriti, which is a strange word, S-M-R-T-I. And it is translated as remembrance. And in the pre-Buddhist world, the Brahmin world, sati involved the ability to accurately and reliably recall all of the Vedic rites and rituals. So that's what it originally meant, was to have a good ability to recollect those rites and rituals. And the idea was that if you remembered them correctly and performed them perfectly, it would appease the gods. So that's what it originally meant. Now, one of the things that I admire about Buddhism, and this is probably typical of many innovative thinkers, is that he took the words and the concepts that he already knew, was exposed to, and repurposed them. So his understanding of smriti, now we'll call it sati, it's a training. It's a process that develops the ability to have a present moment awareness, a non-forgetfulness that allows us to be mindful that the sense of self is a fabrication. very useful one, but there are limits. And fabrication has a great social benefit. It's one of the things that characterizes us as human beings, is that we develop a kind of internal narrative, and we speak to one another. And the limitations to it is that all language is conceptual. Now, one of the problems of language is that because it's conceptual, it is fundamentally inaccurate in terms of really understanding what's going on. And the inaccuracy is particularly important when it comes to what we call the ego. Now, we typically regard the word ego as a noun, my ego, but ego really is a dynamic process that sorts through all of the stimulus that we're exposed to. Hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, sensations inside the body, memories, so forth and so on. So this internal process creates a sense of self. And it's a sorting process in that issues that seem to be irrelevant are ignored, disregarded. And of course, we all, if you look closely at your subjectivity, there's a lot that goes on when you are focused on a particular data stream, if you will, that you're ignoring. You know, right now I'm talking, but you know, there's a kind of peripheral awareness that's somewhat visual, somewhat audible, auditory, kinesthetic in terms of what's going on in my body. So when I'm speaking or thinking, creating this stream of consciousness, that's what the ego is. Now, I've said many, many times that I think this guy we call the Buddha was the first psychologist in human history that we know of, because he was really able to understand this self-creating process, which I call the selfing story. And mindfulness is a key function of the mind, of the brain, in paying attention to this process that forms a self. So, once again, to reiterate, mindfulness is remembering that we are creating a sense of self in an ongoing way. Not becoming lost in the thoughts, but being aware of the process of thinking. The word upatthana is pretty straightforward. To not stray from efforts to be mindful. What we want to be able to do is to sustain sati for extended periods of time, particularly integrating into daily life routines. Now, this is expressed in the Satipatthana Sutta in a particular phrase at the beginning. And how, monks, does he in regard to the body abide contemplating the body? Here, gone to the forest, or to the root of a tree, or to an empty hut. He sits down, having folded his legs crosswise, set his body erect, and established mindfulness in front of him. Mindful, he breathes in. Mindful, he breathes out. Established mindfulness in front of him is the part of that quote that relates to upatthana. Now, when I first learned to practice mindfulness of breathing 40 years ago, the preferred target for attention was the expanding and contracting of the abdomen. And I was trained in this at the Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts. I also was exposed at the time to paying attention to the sensation of breathing at the rim of the nostrils. So we were given these alternatives that we could do. But mostly it was emphasize the expansion and contraction of the abdomen, the physical sensations associated with that. So there was a presumption that what that means is that you pay attention to what's going on in front of the body, either your belly or your nose. And that's certainly valid to an extent. But there's another meaning that is, I think, more valuable for developing this capacity to be mindful, which making sure that it is in the forefront of your mind. That the ability to pay attention, to not be absent-minded, which another way to describe sati is to not be absent-minded. That's putting this ability to pay attention in the forefront. It's primary. Now, as my practice has matured over the years, I start out with mindfulness of breathing. For about a decade, I paid attention at the abdomen. Then I switched to the area around the nostrils, and that's what I do now. But when I practice, the sensation of breathing is sort of the primary, the forefront. But I also systematically include sensations elsewhere in the body. And what I'm trying to do is kind of crowd the bandwidth of my mind, my brain, with a certain kind of physical sensational awareness, making thinking less and less prominent, less and less important. There's still awareness. There's still an intentionality to this process, but it's more holistic in my practice. So what I'm putting to the forefront is what is the main focus of the first foundation of the four foundations of mindfulness, mindfulness of the body. Now I'll be talking more about that practice, mindfulness of the body, going forward. Not tonight, though. But that's what I'm trying to do with this notion of what is satipatthana. It's putting this practice of being mindful in the forefront and using the strategy of whole body awareness with breath sensation as being still the kind of the home base. Some of the ways I've described this is you can imagine that sensation of breathing is like a peg, and there's a rubber band that's attached to the peg, and my attention is at the other end of the rubber band. My attention goes out to something, sound, thought, whatever, but pops back. Keeps popping back to the breath as that primary point of reference, but then become more and more holistic, more and more inclusive of a whole body awareness. So, the Satipatthana Sutta goes further and describes this integrative process as being folded into daily activities. So here's the section of the sutta that reflects this. Called the first part is called the four postures. Again, bhikkhus, when walking, a bhikkhu understands I'm walking. When standing, he understands I'm standing. When sitting, he understands I'm sitting. When lying down, he understands I'm lying down. Or he understands accordingly, however his body is disposed. In this way he abides, contemplating the body as a body internally, externally, and both internally and externally. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That too is how a body abides, contemplating the body as a body. Full awareness. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu is one who acts in full awareness when going forward and returning, who acts in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away, who acts in full awareness when flexing and extending his limbs, who acts in full awareness when wearing his robes and carrying his outer robe and bowl, who acts in full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting, who acts in full awareness when defecating and urinating, who acts in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent. In this way, he abides contemplating the body as a body internally, externally, and both internally and externally, and he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That too is how a bhikkhu abides contemplating the body as a body. Now, there's a lot packed into that terminology, and I will be unpacking it in future talks. But I wanted to provide this quote to illustrate what I'm talking about here with mindfulness. So we want to learn how to be presently aware as we move through the day. Now, those of you who have been on a retreat with me or with other teachers perhaps, but I certainly emphasize this, a residential retreat is set up to provide the opportunity to minimize anything that you do other than just kind of making your body work. No chores, no distractions, so forth and so on. No entertainment, even no talking, or very little talking during the teacher interviews. So from the time you wake up in the morning to the time you go to sleep at night, you want to optimize your opportunity to be mindful in an ongoing way. So this ongoing process is called vipassana, insight. And I'll be talking more about vipassana, that we'll be unpacking that in future talks. But it's basically understood as insight into the three characteristics of our subjective experience. Anicca, which is the transitory nature of our subjective experience, always changing, always flowing. Even when the mind becomes trapped in a particular thought, there's still flowing going on. What we want to do is pay more attention to the flowing, be aware of the content to the extent that we can recognize whether that content is inducing dukkha, distress and confusion, or liberating the mind from dukkha. So that's the second characteristic. First one is anicca, being alert to dukkha, and that leads to the third characteristic, which is anatta, which is the absence of an enduring and autonomous self. So that will be discussed over and over again, those three characteristics, as I go through this extensive review of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. The other thing it's important to understand about sati is that it's kind of the leader. One of the metaphors that's used is the chief minister of a king. The chief minister's job is to oversee the functioning of all the different departments of, you know, the various assigned tasks for the ministers, and manage them, supervise them. and report to the king what's going on. Of course, because there's no self, there's no king, but that's the way the metaphor plays out. So this ministry, if you will, of mindfulness is always accompanied by investigation of mental phenomena and by right effort. Right effort is another aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path, but it basically means the ability to channel the energy of attention, to redirect that energy when dukkha is being manifested, and to sustain that energy when liberation from dukkha is being manifested. When I say liberation from dukkha, what I'm talking about is overcoming or setting aside distress, which is emotional urgency, and confusion. And the way the confusion is set aside is through investigation. Noticing how the sense of self, the ego process, is playing out, how it's manifesting, and being able to keep track of that, not be forgetful, not be absent-minded, not be enchanted by a particular line of thinking or belief or expectation. Just to see it as a mental formation and operate from that perspective. So in the Satipatthana Sutta, and I'll be revisiting this particular phrase repeatedly during the discourse because it keeps showing up over and over again. There are three terms: atapi, sati, sapajanya. Atapi is diligence or ardor. So there's a certain kind of heightened, engaged activity, alertness. Sati is mindful. Sapajanya is clear comprehension. That clear comprehension is investigation of mental phenomena cooperating with right effort. So let me break down this notion of sati a little bit more, certain points. First thing is to understand that it is intentional. Now, in Buddhist psychology, it's assumed that an intention or a volition is involved in every moment of self-formation. The intention is either organized around some kind of wholesome activity or organized around some unwholesome activity in the mind and in the body. But mindfulness is intentionally applied along with investigation and right effort. So you can imagine that the way intention operates is it kind of coordinates activity. It pulls together different factors and creates a kind of cooperative dynamic flow. When we're mindful, that flow is being monitored. But intentionality is really important with that. Now, I'll be revisiting this when I'm talking about mindfulness of breathing, which is part of the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta. You intentionally bring the focus of attention to the beginning of the in-breath. And then you sustain that intention, remaining focused on the duration of the in-breath, trying to pay attention to all the sensations that are there. And then you do the same with the out-breath. You aim your attention at the beginning of the out-breath, sustain that attention for the duration of the out-breath. So right effort is involved in that staying with the breath, and investigation is involved in terms of trying to be aware of the details, if you will, of what occurs. And this obviously encourages diligence, investigation, channeling of the energy of attention. Now, when mindfulness slips, and it will, you know, the mind gets distracted over and over and over again. When mindfulness slips, the attention and the energy will shift to a distraction. Now, let me be clear about that. I mentioned that when I'm doing this whole body awareness, including the breath, thoughts will occur, but they will be peripheral. They will not be center stage. As long as I'm mindful, as long as Atipi Sati Sampajanya is operating, I will be mindfully aware of the phenomena of thinking or of the selfing story. I've said this so many times, doing a lot more lately because it seems so clear to me. The brain is an organ and it functions like other organs. The function of the lungs is to breathe. The function of the heart is to circulate blood. The function of the brain is to think and initiate behaviors. So a thought is something that the brain naturally produces. There's no dukkha in cognition. The dukkha comes about when the cognition is identified as an enduring and autonomous self. That's what we're trying to understand. Not just conceptually, but experientially. So, those are the points that I wanted to make. It's intentional, it's investigative, there's a channeling of that attention. Another metaphor that's been used is that mindfulness is like the guardian at the gate of a walled city. There's only one gate. The mission of that guardian is to, and of course now that guardian, in my understanding, mindfulness, investigation, and right effort, to assess all of the incoming travelers. And if those travelers are enemies, to redirect them away. If those travelers are friends, to invite them in. But you can see that involves investigating the traveler and redirecting the traveler either in through the gate or off to the side. So that's the classical rendering, traditional rendering of mindfulness. Now, when I start to talk about mindfulness of the body, I'm going to also talk about different parts of the brain that are involved in this process of being mindful. There, we know from current research that there's certain neural connections, neural pathways in the brain that are activated, that become stronger and more durable, more powerful, more easily activated through practice. Mindfulness meditation. So, the other thing that I find really interesting, it comes from Wikipedia. Those of you know me that I use Wikipedia often as at least a starting point for my research, for my talks. I'm going to talk about metacognition. Now, you've heard what I said about mindfulness, how it functions, how it operates. Here's the quote from Wikipedia. Metacognition is classified into three components. First one, metacognitive knowledge, also called metacognitive awareness. This is what individuals know about themselves and others as cognitive processors. Metacognitive regulation is the regulation of cognition and learning experiences through a set of activities that help people control their learning. Third one, metacognitive experiences are those that have something to do with the current ongoing cognitive endeavor. Metacognition refers to a level of thinking that involves active control over the process of thinking that is used in learning situations, planning the way to approach a learning task, monitoring comprehension, and evaluating the progress toward the completion of a task. These are skills that are metacognitive in their nature. Metacognition includes at least three different types of metacognitive awareness when considering metacognitive knowledge. First one, declarative knowledge, refers to knowledge about oneself as a learner and about what factors can influence one's performance. Declarative knowledge can also be referred to as world knowledge. Second one, procedural knowledge, refers to knowledge about doing things. This type of knowledge is displayed as heuristics and strategies. A high degree of procedural knowledge can allow individuals to perform tasks more automatically. This is achieved through a large variety of strategies that can be accessed more efficiently. Third, conditional knowledge refers to knowing when and why to use declarative and procedural knowledge. It allows students to allocate their resources when using strategies. This, in turn, allows the strategies to become more effective. Similar to metacognitive knowledge, metacognitive regulation, or regulation of cognition, contains three skills that are essential. First one is planning. It refers to the appropriate selection of strategies and the correct allocation of resources that affect task performance. Monitoring refers to one's awareness of comprehension and task performance. Third, evaluating refers to appraising the final product of a task and the efficiency at which the task was performed. This can include reevaluating strategies that were used. Similarly, maintaining motivation to see a task to completion is also a metacognitive skill. The ability to become aware of distracting stimuli, both internal and external, and sustain effort over time also involves metacognitive or executive functions. The theory that metacognition has a critical role to play in successful learning means it is important that it be demonstrated by both students and teachers. Now, think about what I've been saying at the beginning of this talk about mindfulness and right effort and investigation of mental phenomena. This article in Wikipedia makes no reference. I just quoted a part of it. It's a rather long article. It has all kinds of implications for work performance, for task analysis, for any number of procedures. And even talks about it in terms of social processes. Makes no mention of Buddhism whatsoever. But to me, it mirrors it. I've talked about this in a previous talk a couple of years ago, this whole notion of metacognition and this quote from Wikipedia. I'm going to throw a little extra in here, something I've talked about before, which is in terms of clear comprehension, sampajanya, what are called the four comprehensions, four clear comprehensions. And it's a commentary. It's found in a commentary on what I read to you above about a bhikkhu knows going forward and returning and wearing clothes and eating and all that stuff. That all involves sampajanya, which once again involves mindfulness and investigation and right effort. So the four clear comprehensions. First one is a worthy goal. I'll think about what I was saying in terms of these characteristics of metacognition. What's your goal? What are you trying to achieve? Right? And you define this in terms of Buddhism in the context of the process of overcoming dukkha, of liberating the mind from dukkha. That's the goal. Suitable means. Suitable means for doing this is being mindful. Mindfulness, investigation, and right effort. And the third characteristic is monitoring what you're doing as you're doing it. So this, once again, refers back to, you know, how you carry your robes as a monk, how you eat, you know, how you walk, so forth and so on. Having ongoing procedural awareness, the word procedural awareness, the words procedural awareness were part of the metacognitive quote. So, worthy goal, suitable means, monitoring the process, and the fourth one is keeping it within the parameters of the process of awakening. Now, isn't that interesting? That there's this current, fairly sophisticated psychosocial research that reflects something that's been known by practicing Buddhists for millennia. Isn't that interesting? So, I will be talking more about mindfulness and all of its different characteristics as we go through reviewing the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. More particularly, specifically, mindfulness of the body, because I just kind of gave you a heads up about that with the whole notion of atapi sati sampajanya. So I guess what I want to do now is to open the floor for questions or comments about what you heard me say, to clarify it or any insights you may have about it. Anybody? Including the people here in the room. I hope I didn't just kind of blow you all away with this. I get into my groove and sometimes wonder if you all are just sitting there dazed and confused. John?
The process of being yourself is what you're born with. But my awareness, mindfulness awareness, the Buddhism that we're practicing, is watching yourself being aware. And this monitoring process, it's interesting. It's almost like an echo. But that's in essence what you're doing. You're judging it. You're specifying parts. I mean, it reminds me of a description of a B-52 pilot. But it's fascinating. I think that it is amazing as long as you understand the mental part. It's just being yourself and watching it and then being comfortable with it. And I think when you get confident with that, it's applies across the board and is very helpful.
So let me comment about that. There are two levels. I've mentioned this before. It's worth repeating. The first one has to do with your functionality in society. You know, that you're an ethical person, that you're productive, that you're effective socially, you manage your lifestyle well. That creates a baseline that is relatively undisturbed. Your conscience is clear. Your life is not all tangled up with all kinds of excessive distractions or obligations. So that sets the stage, if you will, for going deeper into this analytic process so that you disassemble or deconstruct the whole ego process. You understand at a very deep and profound level how the self is organized. And that deep understanding creates more and more peace, more and more joy, and more clarity. And it's all monitored by and managed by Adipi Sati Sampajanya. So that's one of, it's like a progression. One stage is kind of integrating your lifestyle, your character, in ways that are effective and ethical, and then moving beyond that to the awakening process, which is more and more of a spiritual aspiration and endeavor. So I think that's really important to emphasize, because even mindfulness is a self-improvement strategy, and that's why it's, you know, it's being integrated more and more into teaching, business, even they're training soldiers to practice mindfulness meditation to help prevent PTSD, but also to make them more efficient soldiers. So it has that kind of social value. But then there's this spiritual value, and my hope is that that doesn't get shoved aside or diminished in its importance. What I'm going to talk about next week is an overview of the Satipatthana Sutta. It's interesting to understand that it has evolved over the time since the original Buddha. And the way that it is structured, I think, is really important to understand in order to be able to maximize the benefits from applying it. Mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of the mind, and mindfulness of mental phenomena. So that's going to be the focus for the next talk. It's our custom at the end of each meeting to sit for a moment, so let's do that. Thank you for your practice. I hope that we're all reasonably safe and happy until the next time we have a chance to meet.